This episode of the Wired UK podcast is brought to you by Braintree V.0, the snippet of code that lets you accept PayPal, Apple Pay, and credit and debit cards in your mobile app or website, all with a single integration. To learn more and to try out the sandbox, go to braintreepayments.com/wirednews. Coming up today, the world's longest tunnel, a ray gun for knocking drones out the sky, and whether we can trust robots. You're listening to episode 270 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host Matt Burgess, and joining me today is Matt Reynolds.
Hello.
And we've also got a newcomer to the Wired podcast and a newcomer to Wired. We've got Victoria Wollaston, Wired.co.uk's new digital editor.
Hello.
So Vicky, you've been with us for about 2 weeks now. How have you been finding things?
It's been a bit of a whirlwind of a fortnight, if I'm honest. But ending my second week with a shiny new website for us to play with is fun. It was designed from scratch, and I may be a little biased, but I think it looks great. And the infinite scrolling on stories is a massive highlight. There are still some bugs we're ironing out, as with any relaunch. On the whole, it's been a relatively smooth switchover, and I can't wait for people to see the Shenzhen series on our new video channel. But I think my biggest achievement so far has been the introduction of Cheese Friday. This week's cheesemonger is Emily, who is fetching a variety of fromage as we speak.
So what is Cheese Friday?
For those
that aren't here in the office with us.
Cheese Friday is just a weekly recognition of how great cheese really is, and it brings everyone together.
And what cheeses did we have last week?
In our inaugural Cheese Friday, we had an applewood smoked, we had a creamy blue, and we had a mature cheddar to try and hit all of the bases. But we're lacking in crackers. We definitely need to up our cracker game.
Yeah, it seems to be something that's gone down well with everybody else so far. And just then you mentioned our new video channel, Wired Video, which is already online. There's a number of videos on there, and also the teaser of our Shenzhen feature, which is coming out in the next few weeks. That's a feature, a full-length documentary that's going to be looking at future cities, how ideas, innovation and business is sort of changing cities and the worlds that we live in. So there's already a number of videos up there. If you want to check out the channel, it's been going down very well this week with everybody who's seen it. It's at wired.co.uk/videos. So Vicky, something that we do at the beginning of every podcast is we have a discussion about something that we've learned this week. We're not going to throw you in straight at the deep end, because Matt Reynolds, you're going to wow us with a new fact that you've learned this week.
Okay, so we all love renewable energy and solar panels in particular, but this is an open fact. When was the first solar panel invented?
I would say mid-80s.
Matt?
I'm going to go for a little bit earlier in the 70s.
You should have gone for a lot earlier. It was the 1880s, so 1883 to be specific, and Charles Fritz developed the first solar panel. It was rubbish. It only changed 1%, converted 1% of the sun's energy into actual electricity. But yeah, very, very early on.
Well, that's something I didn't know, certainly. So Vicky, can you top that at all?
Oh, I don't know if I can top that. I have a bit of a grim fact for you. When penguins are hunting for fish in the sea, they ingest quite a lot of seawater. And to get rid of it, they have a special gland, which actually sits behind their eyes. This gland filters out the salt water from their bloodstream. And to get rid of it, penguins sneeze it out.
Ooh, that does sound pretty grim. And I actually, to keep up that theme, I've actually learned this week about body farms, which are basically giant science laboratories. There's six of them in the US and a couple sort of opening around in other places of the world, where bodies are put out to decompose. So these are donated bodies for scientific experiments, but they're just left outside and to see the effects of what the weather and different situations has on a dead body.
Wow.
Yeah, and it is meant to be sort of a criminal investigation technique to show the differences between how bodies compose. So a body in a trunk of a car, for example, will decompose differently to a one that has been left outside for a few weeks. So it's just learning about how our body changes and the different stages it goes through. And to be honest, if you're interested in this, it is really interesting. Go and have a look. But a little warning, there are a lot of sort of gruesome pictures that aren't something you want to watch after or look at after just eating your dinner. So in the news this week, Matt Reynolds, you've been looking at NASA and its new patents that it's been putting out.
Absolutely. So NASA have gifted 56 patents into the public domain. So they've made them available for anyone to develop, that's anyone that has a technical knowledge and vast amounts of cash, to turn them into realities. So originally these technologies were developed as part of NASA missions, but now they can be put to use in non-aerospace applications, or indeed by lots of the private aerospace exploration companies we've got around today. And they've all been put into NASA's searchable database that has thousands of expired and public patents ready for anyone to have a look at.
So what other sort of things have they released? Are these going to be useful to people who want to go out and create these or recreate these technologies?
Yeah, I'm not sure if I'll be popping to the garden shed and be doing these things, but there's some really intriguing things in there. So one of these especially interesting ones is a patent for a dusty plasma thruster.
That sounds technical.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually surprisingly not technical in my basic understanding. Essentially, a rover could go up to the lunar surface, scoop up some lunar dust, pop it into some very, very, very complicated technology, and use that dust as a kind of propellant to make a rover or a space vehicle move, which is awesome, because at the minute, if you want to extract hydrogen from lunar ice, you need to, have a way of doing that, breaking down the water and stuff. But this really turned dust into thrust.
That sounded so corny, but we're gonna stick with it. And is there anything else that's really interesting out of these 56 new ones?
Yeah, there's another one that's really cool. I think you guys might have heard of aerogel before, that really awesome solid that's lighter than any other solid. So it's 99.8% air. And it's really awesome because it's very, very strong, but it also has very low thermal conductivity. So it's really good for a heat shield, which is something obviously spacecraft need as they're kind of going through the atmosphere. Problem with aerogel is super, super brittle, and it loves water. It'll soak up lots of water. So what one patent NASA have released, it coats aerogel with an outer polymer that makes aerogel really, really strong and also waterproof. So there could be some quite exciting applications of that in the future.
So anyone can just crack on with these patents?
Yeah, in theory, that's exactly what they're there for. So they've been released into public domain, so anyone can pick them up, and all the details of how to make these things are there. Actually, I mean, these innovations are at a very, very early stage, and NASA have released them really because there's not an awful amount of commercial viability in them. So it's not like they were thinking, oh, we could sell this. You know, if there's people that wanted to buy this product or these eventual, products, they would have actually developed them themselves. So really, you've probably got a lot of work to be getting on with. Also, some of them are completely ununderstandable to, someone like me. One of the ones I came across was a novel ferromatic conducting lignosulfic acid dope polyaniline. So if you want to make one of those or whatever you do with one of those, then, good luck. But obviously you're much, much, much cleverer than me.
Yeah, I think we'll leave some of those down to the experts to develop. And Vicky, you've been actually looking and learning a little bit about a new ray gun, which is going to be tested in the US to take down drones.
Yeah, so the ray gun was actually, it was first demonstrated last October, but it's been back in the news this week because it's going to be tested at some US airports. It's officially known by the less than catchy anti-UAV defence system, but it's just been granted approval by the Federal Aviation Administration for the trial to begin. So airlines and the administration are looking for ways to safely stop drones hitting planes, especially as the gadgets become more popular.
And what does it look like and sort of how does it work?
So it looks like, I would say, if you've ever played a first-person shooter game, it looks a little bit like a shoulder-mounted RPG. Obviously, it's not that dangerous. But the British firms behind the technology describe it as a way to disrupt or neutralise drones that are, and I quote, engaged in hostile airborne surveillance and potentially malicious activity. Now, put more simply, any drone that's considered a threat to the safety of a plane is targeted with a thermal imaging camera on the top. And this can be done from as far away as 6 miles. The system then jams the signals being sent to the drone, meaning the person controlling it can't steer it, can't land it, can't pose a threat.
It's a pretty extreme approach. So is this problem of drones fretting a plane or hitting a plane, is that something that is a reality?
Well, look, it can't hurt to be at least prepared for these sorts of things. In January, an Oxford research group said terrorists in particular could use UAVs to attack flights. When asked, the FAA justified the upcoming trial with just sometimes people fly drones in an unsafe manner. But back in April, a plane landing at Heathrow was thought to have collided with a drone. But the drone was never found, and a government transport minister later said it could have just been a plastic bag. It's not my favourite method of tackling the problem, though. Police in the Netherlands have trained eagles to take down drones on sight, and the Met Police said it was interested in a similar trial. The Met is also interested in bringing down drones with old-school nets catapulted into the air.
Yeah, and Matt, you actually wrote a few weeks ago about a shoulder-propelled gun system, which is fires a net into at drones as well.
Yeah, exactly. So it wasn't as sophisticated as kind of radar jamming or, you know, radio signal blocking. Essentially, it was a kind of big net that was propelled towards a drone, kind of burst open just before impact, and brought the drone back with a parachute. So it was meant to bring the drone to land safely so you could then inspect it and see what it had been looking at. So, yeah, quite sinister.
And it seems to be an issue that a lot of airports are taking seriously as well, because I know you've, Matt, you've done a lot of things with a lot of reviews of drones recently. So there are other ways to stop drones from going near airports as well, such as GPS systems?
Yeah, so some drones have got built into them GPS systems that stop them flying above a certain altitude or flying within certain locked areas. Of course, these aren't uniform across drone manufacturers yet, so there's a certain level of, you know, collaboration that needs to be put in place for these to happen. And also, drone flyers and anyone likes breaking rules. So quite often, you know, as it's such a new technology, we're at that stage where really these limits and technological limitations on them really are quite an early stage of being worked out. So there are a lot of teething problems, I think.
Yeah, that does seem to be the case. And as far as I'm aware, there are going to be some drone regulations that are consulted on later this year, as well as ones that already exist that look to introduce a new register for drone owners in this country. So it's surely going to be something that we keep covering on Wired for the foreseeable future. And elsewhere this week, the world's longest and deepest rail tunnel has officially been opened in Switzerland. The tunnel stretches 57 kilometres, which is 35 miles, and is called the Gotthard Base Tunnel due to the region of the world that it's in. And it's taken 17 years to complete the construction after the plans were initially drawn up 68 years ago by an engineer called Karl Gruner.
So how does it compare to other tunnels? You know, how long is it?
Yeah, so as I said, it's 35 miles long and 57 kilometres. And that makes it the longest rail tunnel in the world. It's overtaken Japan's 53.9 kilometre Seikan rail tunnel. And I apologise if I've got that pronunciation wrong. And it's actually pushed the Channel Tunnel, going from the UK to France, into third place, which is just a mere 50 kilometres long. And the new tunnel, which was completed on time and within its $12 billion budget even, travels up to 2.3 kilometres below the surface of the Earth because it's going under the Alps, and will carry high-speed trains all the way across from northern Switzerland to southern Switzerland.
That's quite far, but how do you go about making a tunnel like this?
So obviously it's a massive feat of engineering. It's, as we've said, it's been planned for many years. It's taken 17 years to produce and actually to finish. But to create the tunnel, engineers used 4 different boring machines going from different directions. So from the start, going one way, and then the other end of the tunnel going the other way, and they met in the middle. But the boring machines themselves were 410 metres long, which is roughly the equivalent of 4 football pitches end to end. And the self-contained machine cut rock away from the head in the direction it was drilling, and removed it using a bucket wheel system which was contained. And during the creation of the tunnel, the boring machines dug out 28.2 million tons of rubble as engineers drilled through 73 different types of rock. And for the tunnel itself, there's going to be 65 passenger trains going through a day, and more commercial freight trains are going to be going through as well.
Well, I don't know if boring machine is fair. Sounds like an interesting machine to me. Do you have any more facts you can hit us with?
Yeah, so because this has taken so long, there's a lot of different facts here, and I'm going to just whisk through a few of them because we find it quite fascinating here. In total, there's been 152 kilometres of tunnel dug in all directions, including safety tunnels, cross passages, access tunnels. Across these tunnels, there are 4 emergency stop stations, 2 per tube. There are 13 kilometres of new overground lines, 4 million cubic metres of concrete has been used, 308 kilometres of track have been laid, 500 kilometres of drain pipes, 7,200 lights, and the journey between the two places will be 45 minutes quicker because of this tunnel. Vicky, you've been fascinated by this tunnel all week. What do you think of it?
I love this tunnel, and I have no idea why I love it so much. The pictures that we have on wired.co.uk are incredible. The feat of engineering that goes into this sort of thing is beyond belief. When you think also the plans were drawn up 40, 50 years ago, we didn't have the technology that we have now. The vision of that engineer is just incredible. And while we wait for the Hyperloop to actually become a reality, this seems like a really good transport option to get across Europe.
Yeah, and Matt, have you been on either of the two longest tunnels? Have you ever been to France on a Eurostar?
So I've been to France on Eurostar, which I think is, pretty fascinating. I think it's really, really cool that you can go, under the sea in a tunnel. So I personally think that this Swiss tunnel's cheating a little bit, because it's like, if you've got a mountain on top of you, then yeah, you're going to be deep. For me, this isn't, national pride or whatever, but I think going under the sea, now that's super cool. Let's build a tunnel to America.
Yeah, and speaking of that, there are actually some plans that in China, which involves creating longer and deeper tunnels than this. I don't think they've actually been started yet, but this one, the new Gotthard Base Tunnel, might not be keeping its world record for as long as its engineers would probably hope. Coming up after the break, we'll be discussing how robots are finally making their way into the workplace. There's been a lot of rumours and a lot of reports saying that robots may eventually replace millions of workers. But to do so, we're actually going to have to trust them and put our faith in these robots. So we're going to be discussing what it takes to make robots useful to humans.
By next year, maybe even next week, there could be a whole new way to pay. Maybe it'll be the next Bitcoin or the next Apple Pay, or maybe even both. Fortunately, Braintree's full-stack payment platform is easily adaptable to whatever the future holds, so you can adapt easily too. Accept everything from pounds to PayPal to that next big innovation, from any device with just one integration. And when that new payment method comes out, all you'll have to do is update a few lines of code. No late nights, no complicated recoding, no stress about staying ahead of the curve. Braintree is here to help. Learn more at braintreepayments.com/wirednews.
Welcome back. There aren't any in the Wired office, but robots are starting to be put to work in various scenarios around the world. One area where robots are set to take over the world is in service jobs. So these are the jobs that are quite manual jobs, and providing a direct service or a particular feature to people. So for example, in a hotel, it may be delivering a small item to somebody who's in their room, so room service, that type of thing is what is considered as a sort of a direct service job. This week on Wired.co.uk, we've actually had an article from the latest issue of our magazine, which describes how these types of robots are actually becoming a reality and being put into the real world. Vicky, you've had a look at what robots there are at the moment, what service robots there are, and what they're really capable of.
So yeah, in the piece that we have online, there's one in particular robot called Relay. It's an armless device. Like you said earlier, it works in a hotel. It's just under about a metre tall, and it does act as room service. So you can call this robot, ask it for whatever you want, whether it's a toothbrush, a bottle of water, a gin and tonic, from the hotel's front desk. It'll go and collect your goods and take it to your room. What's interesting about this Relay robot is that the hotels are having to retrofit their lifts so the robots can use them, which is fascinating. On the Harmony of the Seas, the cruise ship, they have cocktail robots. These robots are just single arms that will make your drinks. So you order on an iPad, you then say what kind of drinks you want, whether you want ice, and this robot will go and it'll pick up a cup, it'll fill it with ice, it'll go to the different spirits, it'll have a mixer, and then you use your room card to bring the drink towards you. Earlier on this week in Computex, Asus introduced the Zenbo. So obviously at the moment we're talking like quite service industry, but this Zenbo robot could in fact be in your home. And it could even launch within sort of the next year. And Asus says it'll be able to move around your house, it'll know your family, play games with your kids, read stories, cook for you, place phone calls and all sorts. One of the areas that they're also looking to do is to look after elderly people. A lot of these robots are very mechanical, they're sort of single arms, quite robotic, obviously. But in Japan, they're looking to make them a little bit softer, especially if you're caring for elderly people, certainly ones with mental conditions. So there's one called Robear, which is designed a little bit. It's a cross between a bear and Baymax. And what it does is it's meant to be this soft, relatively cuddly robot that can lift patients out of beds, put them into wheelchairs, and just generally soften that whole area.
Yeah, and I think one of the main examples as well is also Pepper, the emotional robot, which has been designed and sold out within in China for, I think, 1,000 units sold out in the first minute, which is designed to sort of interact and speak to you a little bit more. And Matt, that's one of the big issues with these sort of robots and whether we're going to really trust them to sort of provide us with services, that do they understand us?
Yeah, I think that's a really big issue. I think a major limiting factor on and how we interact with robots and how capable they are of understanding human speech, at a genuine level that's beyond word recognition. So Facebook's doing something very interesting here. They're developing a deep learning algorithm that can understand posts and messages with near human accuracy. It's called Deep Text, and it's an algorithm that uses natural language programming to actually understand the intention behind phrases. So it's quite a subtle difference, but if you typed, "I need a taxi," you know, in a conversation with your friend, Deep Text would recognize what you're saying in your messenger conversation and give you a link to a taxi. If you said, "Oh, I just came out of a taxi," you know, again, sending a message to your friend, Deep Text would realize you weren't intending to get a taxi. You're not talking about the future, so it wouldn't serve you that type of link. And what this really does is it pushes language recognition beyond just keyword recognition, which is what, you know, a lot of these kind of voice services do at the minute. They pick up a word and they're like, "Great, you want a taxi?" Really, what's quite interesting about this and why Deep Text is able to do this in such a sophisticated way is just think about the vast amount of human language that's on Facebook. There's 125,000 comments every minute are posted on the social media platform. So Deep Text has a massive repository of data to mine and go in and understand how humans are talking. So, you know, actually, they're not developing, you know, a service robot in any way, but really the technology that goes behind this Deep Text could have really big implications for creating service robots we really want to talk to and can talk to.
Yeah, so as you just said, that this is obviously something from Facebook, which is going to understand and allow Facebook to understand how humans talk a little bit more naturally. And for Facebook, they're going to involve this in their own messenger bots, the sort of artificial intelligence bots which have been created to sort of speak to people, which on a level you could consider a sort of service artificial intelligence, because if you are saying, "Oh, I want to buy a pizza and have it delivered here," and this language can understand you, that's the sort of next step. So Matt, you just briefly mentioned how it could be used in robots. Do you think that this is something that will be used in robots?
I think so, yeah. I think that essentially we're always going to be thinking about what's the most useful and natural way to communicate with someone. And I think really we spend all of our lives chatting to each other. And, you know, that's maybe the form of communication, as well as body language and stuff like that, that comes most naturally to humans. And I think good technology and good technology firms are always trying to meet that. You know, touchscreen is a great example. Rather than pressing buttons, you know, gesturing with your fingers and stuff like that, it feels a bit more natural. I think really we'll see ourselves and see technology moving towards more natural modes of interaction. So it's not like, "God, I've got to put on my robot voice now," or "got to be really clear for Siri." Just interact with a robot just like I'm talking now. To me, that seems the logical endpoint of making robot-human interactions useful.
Yeah, and you mentioned Siri there. Obviously, we were just talking about Facebook. They're not the only ones that are doing this, developing natural language and how we actually communicate with artificial intelligence and eventually maybe robots. But one of the biggest issues is whether we will trust them. And there has actually been some studies looking at how humans and robots interact already. And a study from the Georgia Institute of Technology a few weeks ago suggested that humans will thoughtlessly trust a rescue robot, in this case, to save you, when it may not actually be the case and the robot may have a problem with it. So in the study, some test subjects followed a robot which had "emergency guide robot," not at all suspicious, written on the side of it, and they proved that humans would actually follow it. So in the study, 42 subjects were put into a room where an alarm went off. They followed the robot out of the room. In some cases, they followed it past obstacles. They followed it around small gaps where people actually had to squeeze through and may not be the most obvious route. But because this robot was there and because they had previously interacted with it, they tended to trust it. And even if the robot was going against what may be sort of human instincts. So there is obviously this sort of natural capacity for us to be able to trust robots, even in some certain cases where it may not be the best example too. And when they can start speaking to us and communicating with us, that's all going to tie together to create this sort of complete package. And Vicky, would you trust a robot to be looking after your grandparent, for example, in a, if it's a service robot or a healthcare robot in this case?
See, just going back slightly to the trusting a robot issue, the way that they followed that experiment. Back in the 60s, there were psychology experiments where all you need to do is put a man in a white coat and people automatically think they're an authority figure. So I think that may be a wider issue, that it wasn't necessarily that they'll trust a robot. I think what that shows is that people are increasingly starting to look at robots as humans almost. And even, I mean, there was a study last week that found that you could, that people would assign a gender to a robot if you use stereotypical male and female images on a touchscreen. And a lot, and in the majority of cases, you would look at a robot and refer to it as a he. And that it's that mindset which is fascinating, but it's also a little bit concerning, because you're right. I think service robots should add something to my experience. I think if I go to a hotel and it's quicker for someone to bring me a toothbrush or a drink and it's a robot, that's great. But I think when you start relying on those robots to take care of people or to enter the medical industry, you're taking away the warmth of a human. And I think that certainly when you're looking after elderly people, that can play a major role in how people and how families react to that and how elderly people react to that. And they always say about doctors having a good bedside manner. So these robots would have to have an equally good bedside manner, and they'd need to be warm and they'd need to be friendly for me to want to put one of my relatives in their care.
And to play a slight devil's advocate, we mentioned Japan earlier, and that is a country which has got a massively elderly population or aging population. Do you think that when there is a case that there isn't enough doctors or humans, that robots will be able to sort of supplement care maybe?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that's what I mean about, I think service robots should always complement the humans that are doing the job as well. I'm a bit concerned that I don't think they should ever replace us, obviously for my own self-preservation. But I think it's a bit worrying when if you're putting all of your trust in them. And you also need to remember that these robots at the moment are being programmed by humans, and humans make mistakes. So if you have got an algorithm, for example, we had all the problem with the Facebook trending topics and all the bias that goes with that. They're still humans who have their own bias making these algorithms and making these robots. So you need to factor that in as well, that these robots aren't going to be these absolute clinical, get everything right every time, because they are programmed by people who make mistakes.
And Matt Reynolds, do you agree with that? Do you think that Vicky's right and that robots should be supplementing humans? Or can you see a future where we are going to have certain jobs or industries, for example, that have robots completely replacing us?
Yeah, I think it probably splits into a few different categories. I think there are certain jobs, say, warehouse manufacturing, where, you know, you might say like a forklift truck driver, and if you're moving a pallet from point A to point B, probably a robot can do that, because you're probably not interacting on a human level. It might not require any real agility of thought in terms of thinking around different problems. So I can see that there are definitely certain industries and certain jobs that are kind of real candidates for you know, being replaced by robots in that respect. But I kind of agree with Vicky. I think there are certain elements, and actually that, you know, where robots can't really be replaced. I think that, you know, being a doctor, having a really good bedside manner and having that human touch is really important. I actually think the hotel one's an interesting middle ground, really, because are hotels all about service and getting stuff on demand, or are they about being kind of pampered? And, you know, is it about having someone come up and thinking someone has taken the care to do it and not just I've got instant access? I mean, I think that's a kind of like interesting middle ground, really, and I don't know. And I think that maybe you'll have different approaches. You get some hotels that are super, super efficient, and some hotels that are really like that will take care of you as a human. You know, you might see certain industries splitting into two different paths here.
And I think the middle ground in what you're talking about in the home as well, because I think it would be amazing to have a robot come in and cook me my dinner. I mean, the Channel 4 series Humans showed off that sort of side of things. But I think it's really sad when you read a line that says, and it could read bedtime stories to your children. That really pains me, because the idea of you just sort of passing your child on to a robot and your child having a relationship with a robot rather than you makes me quite sad.
Yeah, and it is a field that is clearly developing. There are going to be a lot of different levels on what robots may be able to do in the future and may not be able to do, because at the moment they're all still very basic. The robots featured in our article online and in the magazine, they are doing quite often jobs that robots can do a little bit better than humans. So, for example, there's one of them which goes around a shop and scans all the shelves to check the inventory. That would take a human a lot longer to do. So I think, as we've both touched upon there, or you both touched upon there, there's probably going to be a few cases where this is going to be possible for robots to be better than us. But to move slightly on a little bit, what about jobs that are maybe not quite as manual? So like, there are robot journalists that are already being developed. Do we think our jobs are at threat, or do we think jobs that are going to be slightly more creative? Does anybody think that they're going to be changing? Or
I think it's a bit concerning when you see reports that a teacher, a robotic teacher, an AI software, was teaching a class for however many months online, and no one realised they were talking to a robot. that's quite concerning. And I think there will be a place where robots become so creative and so intelligent. I mean, even Google, granted its poems may not be quite up there yet, but looking into that creativity, I think is definitely a threat to journalism. I don't think it will ever replace us. You can't get the same sort of context, and you can't get the adjectives, and you can't sit down with an interviewee and really extract details from them if you're a robot. So they may be able to do the hard and fast news stories using information from Twitter, agencies or what have you. But I think when it comes to the real life stories, I don't think they'll ever threaten us.
And I think that, you know, Vicky, the teacher example is an interesting one, because I think there's another element. There's the technology catching up to the profession, but then it's also the expectations of what that profession does. And I think if, for instance, you had a government that said, well, teachers teach this syllabus and you can sum it up on these A4 sheets, then if you become someone that's just delivering that material and that content, then yeah, it makes sense a robot could do that, you know, and or I could do it. I could stand up and read it. But I think that it's almost like, maybe we have to rethink these professions and what we expect from them, and how we expect, you know, creativity and humanity and nimble thinking to kind of add things that robots can't do. You know, let's not think of humans as content delivery bots. So let's stop, you know, automating ourselves in a way, and we can, you know, get away from the robots and hopefully make ourselves more useful.
That may be the case, and as things go on, we'll see how these things develop and where robots do replace humans, and if they do replace humans in certain jobs. But that's all for this week's podcast. As ever, if there's any feedback, you can get us on wired.co.uk. Our contact details are on there. You can email us at podcast@wired.co.uk, or you can tweet us @wiredUK. You can tweet Vicky on
@VickyWolliston.
You can tweet Matt Reynolds,
@MattSReynolds1.
And you can tweet me @MattBurgess1. So we'd love to hear what you think of the show and anything that we've been producing through the week, things we should be covering, things we shouldn't be covering. But thank you very much for listening, and we'll speak to you all next week.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.